like that.
You got enough batteries?
Okay, everyone, I've sent it out. Turn it by in. We apologize to the students, whoever are standing. If there are maybe younger children, younger people, younger adults, please make pretend your seats over to people who could use them more, please. I want to apologize and preface my comments. Unfortunately, I've contracted a pretty significant condition that's causing me a lot of discomfort, a lot of pain. I've been dead the last 2 days and haven't really eaten anything. And my wife's about to murder me for coming today, but I just felt that this is the 50th anniversary of Giver War, and you just saw the heroism as I dragged my body out and tried to honor Abimelech's memory. And the whole day, as I was deliberating, yes to come, not to come, yes to come, not to come, at like 5 o'clock, I remember the following story. In 2003, Rav Amital had a commemoration of the Yom Kippur War. So then he remembers meeting someone in the Chovo before the war, but Holocaust survivor, and he said, please bring me a tape recorder, bring me a tape recorder. Why? Because there's a negative town we used to sing in our shtetl in Europe, and I'm the last one who remembers. If we don't record that negative, it's going to disappear forever. And please, bring a tape recorder. And Rav Amital said, we lost 8 songs, and those songs were lost. So I worked very hard on this to honor my Rebbe, and I felt there's a moment here in time because it's the 50th anniversary. If I don't give this year now, who knows when I'll have the opportunity to give it. So I apologize if I'm a little bit disarrayed and a little bit weak, but I felt this is important. The Yom Kippur War was a much more confusing, traumatic, and triumphant war. In many ways, the Nisim of the Yom Kippur War, they were different than the Nisim of the Chumash Hashanah and the Six-Day War. But it wasn't a war that provided clear and self-evident, transparent religious messages, clear messianic connotations. It was a war that was very difficult to organize and to articulate. A lot of trauma, a lot of confusion. Our borders weren't altered, as we did usually. And it raised more questions than it provided answers. And Rav Amital, in the weeks and months after the war, both in yeshiva, his sichot, in his interviews on the radio, and public speeches, wrestled with these issues very courageously, very authentically, as we knew him. And he distilled many ideas in the aftermath of the Yom Kippur War, which became, I think, tenets of his view of Jewish history and Jewish identity. So if you want to understand Rav Amital, go back to the end of the Sukkot. When I read the Sukkot, I read that 5-6 times the last 2-3 weeks just to let them settle in. I said, my goodness, I've heard these ideas so many times from him. I arrived in Jew in 1983, in the 80s, and the 90s. So we began to formulate a view of Jewish history and Jewish identity. Now, he didn't ignore the sadness, obviously. You saw the quote from Rav Lichtenstein that he gave the keys to Rav Lichtenstein. Part of what made articulating or distilling the messages of the Yom Kippur War so challenging is the entire yeshiva, the entire country was shrouded with sadness and trauma and suffering and shock. And Rav Amital didn't ignore this. He quoted it's a Shulchan Aruch, a quote from Shulchan Aruch, source number one. Person loses a parent, you would make a bracha of bad amis. If that parent happens to have funds that you then inherit, you make a bracha of shechianu or tov emetiv. And Rav Amital oftentimes cited his halacha as a symbol of the fact that life is very complex. One of his favorite words is more kavut. Life is very complex and very rarely provides sheer euphoria or utter darkness and gloominess. It's more often a mixture. And you have to learn how to parse the two and not ignore the two. He certainly didn't ignore the sadness and the suffering. I'll talk about this hopefully later. Quoted Medrash, Ovdei Elilim, other nations, source number two, when they succeed, they thank their gods, and when they suffer, they curse them. Source number two, line two. Avalaten, HaKadosh Baruch Hu asks us, Tadesem Aleichem Es HaTova, when I provide you with prosperity, Titni Hodaya, thank me. When you suffer, Titanir Hodaya. Part of what makes monotheism so transcendent is we know we can't understand Hashem. So we don't predicate our response or our thank you to our Kodesh Baruch Hu based on how our minds process the world we live in. And Rav Amital delivered that to us in his experiences in the Holocaust. So there was a sadness, and Rav Amital didn't ignore the sadness, didn't ignore the grief. But he built this image of Jewish history, and I'll tell you the three parts of it he responded to. I think the Holocaust prepared him. He said once that he went from being a Holocaust survivor and trying to console people who lost their parents to a Rebbe or a Yeshiva and trying to console parents who lost their children. And he lived that loss very, very deeply in his life. I remember towards the end of his life, one of the boys died in Yeshiva in a training accident. And he was crying to us Friday night, as he always did in his speech. He says, I'm too old for this. I can't take this anymore. I didn't think I'd still have to watch coffins being taken with my talmidim. And what made it so fascinating is that he didn't have a masara. He was articulating the meaning of a military victory. We lost the masara. If we think of David HaMelech, we think of David HaMelech as the author of Tehillim. David HaMelech is also the warrior, the great warrior. But for thousands of years, we haven't battled. And he was building a fabric in which there was absolutely no background. Just to show you how powerful it is, and sometimes we read through it, Mirz Hashem on Shabbos, the last pasuk of Moshe Rabbeinu, source number 3, Ashrecha Yisrael Mika Melcha, before he goes up the mountain, Am Moshe Hashem, Magen Ezrecha, Bashecherev Gavasecha, Kodesh Baruch Hu is your prideful sword, Yikechashu Gachalach, and your enemies will submit to you, Betalam Tzayim Tidrach, and you'll trample upon them. He's psukim. Had it resonated for 2,000 years. We weren't trampling anyone. We were being trampled upon. We didn't have an army. We didn't have... So he's trying to articulate meaning to a war that wasn't immediately and overtly messianic. And he tried to provide that religious meaning. And he also tried to provide messianic meaning because he thought that the messianic process had begun. And certainly in the 70s, he was much more messianic than he was later in his life. And just had to have some messianic element to it. The problem is we have no messianic text, because it hasn't happened yet. So we're looking to this dark future, and the best we can do is grope around for answers and try to cut through the mystery. The Rambam writes, source number 4, this entire messianic trajectory, no one will know about it until it happens. Shidvarab Sturimay means the Levian, because the Levian kept this cryptic. So he had no background or no precedent for how to parse military victories. He had no precedent, and yet he tried to draw meaning, religious meaning, messianic meaning. And of course he faced the question that evidently was on everyone's minds, that will this state survive? Because that was an existential moment. If people were wondering about the future of the state of Israel in the days before the Six-Day War, and once the euphoria of the Six-Day War happened, all those questions were muted and smothered by the victory and the triumph. Yom Kippur War, no one was thinking war, sadly, before the Yom Kippur War, but in the days and months after, people were asking themselves a very hard question. How and if will this country survive in such a hostile world with diplomatic chess matches between Russia and the United States, Soviet Union, the East Bloc, the Left Bloc, oil embargoes? Is there a future to our people? And in answering that question, he crafted, I think, his thesis of Jewish history. We'll get to that later. He also taught us in his writings and his lectures never to skip steps. It's very easy to become ideological. What ideological meaning can I draw from this? Before you draw ideological meaning, before you darshan this way or that way, a yid stands in front of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, and how does he respond to a difficult moment, to an Eis Tzara? He davens, and he spoke to the Talmidim about davening, as you saw, of course, learning, strengthening your emuna, not just your emuna, Kodesh Baruch Hu, but your emuna in this redemptive process that has begun, that unfortunately seems to be taking a harsher trajectory than we would have liked. There are different models of redemption we would have hoped would be smoother, more elegant. And finally, the third peg of how you respond to an Eis Tzara is davening and learning, emuna, and a cheshbon nefesh. And not a cheshbon nefesh where you point the finger at other people and say it's your fault and your fault and your fault. And God forbid the people who are saying the reason that we suffered in Yom Kippur in 1973 is because of 67 people said kol hakavod l'tzal. It's morally arrogant, theologically bankrupt to try to play a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Cheshbon HaNefesh for yourself, not for other people. It's easy to conduct a Cheshbon HaNefesh for other people. And the Cheshbon HaNefesh, Rav Amital told us, starts with Avos Yisrael. And he quoted all the Midrashim and Tanakh about Achav and Yeravam, who were horrible, horrible leaders because they refused to forgive Am Yisrael, because they protected Am Yisrael, as opposed to Eliyahu, who was very vigilant and fanatic and somewhat discrediting to the Jewish people. So we learn to be careful, not to skip steps. And sometimes you become so intoxicated with the ideology and the meaning and the deeper meaning, you skip basic steps in how Oved Hashem responds, and of course, trample human emotions, and you didn't do that either. So ideology is the third part of your response. The first part of your response is tshuva, and Talmud Torah, and Zakah, and Cheshbon Nefesh, and the second part is suffering human beings and reaching out to them, maybe it's the first. But what was his ideological response? What meaning did he draw? As I alluded to before, I feel that he was wrestling with three issues. Issue number one, what is the historical significance of this war? The historical significance of 1948 is obviously, it's obvious, the creation of the state of Israel. This had no obvious historical yield. We began just in the same place, and we ended in the same place we began. Number two, what is messianic yield? What is messianic influence? 67, clear messianic connotations, clear messianic resonance. The Kotel, Harabai, Zbiyadeinu, Yushalayim. How is this part of the overall messianic process? And number three, how do we know? How do we know that the Jewish people will survive? So let's get down to business and start with part one. Part one, first of all, Rav Amital, and he stated this with every war, not just with this war. Every single war to defend the Jewish state is a Muhammad mitzvah, because our state represents a Kodesh Baruch Hu. And even soldiers who aren't conscious that they're battling on behalf of a Kodesh Baruch Hu, that consciousness isn't necessary to be Mechadosh Shemayim. You quote the Rambam to us, the excerpt of the Rambam, source number 5. The Rambam describes how a person should fight courageously, without any fear, without any ulterior thoughts. Me'achashi yikanis b'kishri ha'melchama. When you enter the battle, yishain ha'mikve Yisrael. You should rely on Kodesh Baruch Hu, the hope of the Jewish people. Ve'yeda. And you should realize, shal yichud Hashem hu osim melchama. You're defending not just the land of Israel, but you're defending HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'yasin nafsho b'chapo, v'lo yifachei. And then the Rambam says towards the end, source 5, part line 3, v'kala nilcham b'chaliba b'lo pachat v'tia kavanasa l'kadosh Hashem milvad, you get extra stock. So if you're not just fighting on behalf of Israel, but you understand the religious framework, then of course you'll get more stock. But in the initial comments, the Rambam doesn't demand kavanah. The Rambam says, as long as you're fighting on behalf of the Jewish people and the Jewish state, you're defending HaKadosh Baruch Hu, defending Hashem's presence in this world as a Mechemes Mitzvah Nikidosh Hashem. Obviously, if you're aware of it, then it's a deeper and richer experience of Maravidal and Refarge. But that applies to any war. What made this war uniquely religious? So Rav Amital identified two aspects. Number one, the fact that the war broke out in Yom Kippur. Rav Amital saw this as indicative of that our enemies, of course, subconsciously, they planned it in Yom Kippur for logistical reasons, hoping that we won't be able to mobilize by the time Yom Kippur was over, they'd be standing on the banks of the Kidar. That was their plan. So for them, it was logistical and tactical. But Rav Amital believed in that physical arena, in which there are truths that you can't discern, or you can't interview people, and they'll respond. And the fact that they attacked us in Yom Kippur indicated that this was not a geopolitical skirmish, but this was a battle over the people of HaKadosh Baruch Hu returning to their homeland and launching history, resetting history. And remember, I think it was 2003, it was 20 years ago, the 30th anniversary. It was Yom Kippur before Ne'ilah, and Rav Amital's Sichot before Ne'ilah were legendary. The only thing I can compare it to, and I wish I could have been there, were the Sichot of Levi Yitzchak Mibardichev. He was talking to us, he was talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he was talking to us, he was talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he was crying. Remember the first year Rav Amital was Nifter, I sat down to listen to Rav Meidan, he was a pretty good speaker. We gave the pre-Nila Sicha and Yeshiva, and I sat next to Rav Bazak, and Rav Meidan got up and we both put our heads down and started bawling. How could we daven Nila without Rav Amital? Where on Tfilas go without Rav Amital? And he was crying. He said, you know why we won the war? You know why the war turned? The courage of our soldiers and the heroism. But also, he said, the fact that it was impossible in Shemayim that Yom Kippur, the great gift to the Jewish people, should be turned against them, to be weaponized against. It was impossible. It couldn't happen in Shemayim. The very prospect that Yom Kippur would be a weapon would be a disadvantage for Am Yisrael. Salachti kibberecha. Lord kebel b'shamayim. And he quoted often. These are all midrashim that are quoted in many different contexts. Shamamim yirgaza. What makes them rage? What makes them angry? Kivan shashamu umal sa'olam shakadosh baruch hu herim karanam shal yisrael v'achnisa la'aretz. Source number 6. When they hear, when they see that the people of Hashem are returning to the city of Hashem, they become angry. They know that Yerushalayim is where history began. They know that Yerushalayim is where history will end. They know that when the Jewish people return to Yerushalayim and return to Eretz Israel, history is relaunched. That alignment is reattained. People, land, and Kisei Shamayim. Amal Hamakom Shotim Shiva'olam Kama Malachim Malchum Mikem. How many kings did you have? Kama Shotonim, source number 6. V'yachshav Atem Kosim. So for Rav Amital, the timing of Yom Kippur wasn't incidental. Again, it may have been based on military strategies, but for Rav Amital, was indicative of a larger dynamic happening. Number 2, the internationalization of the war. This war was framed, or was embedded, in a very, very complex web of international dynamics. The Cold War was at its height. There were many foreign soldiers who fought with Egypt and Syria, and not just Arabs, many other from other countries. Russia, heavily, heavily armed. Egypt and Syria. And through some miracle, because Nixon wasn't always the greatest army of Israel, some of the State Department, and wasn't always the greatest friends of the Jewish people. Otherwise, you'd be in Operation Nickelgrass. That was quadruple the amount of arms sent to Egypt. Major, major airlifts to our people. We had circled the 3rd Egyptian Army towards the end of the war. And we were encouraged. Some of you probably saw the movie Golden. We were encouraged by Kissinger to stand down and let the army retreat out of fear that the Soviet Union would actually enter the war. There was a real, real threat, real danger. This is not a war fought on the sands of Sinai and the Suez Canal and the hilltops of the Golan. This is a war that started to stretch its tentacles into the broader international dynamic of the 70s. And of course, in the post-war era, and some of you remember, I remember the oil embargo, in which oil was weaponized and used to punish friends of Israel. I remember waiting online. I remember checking the license plate, whether our license plate was odd or even, or was it even day of the month, an odd day of the month, or we can get guess. If our return to this country is part of some larger trajectory, larger human narrative about the human experience and the human geist and trying to inspire an entire world, not just repatriate our people, then major milestone events, including wars in the State of Israel, have to be incorporated and influenced, and in turn influence larger international calculus. Pasuk says in Tehillim, source number 7, Hamu goyim, goyim are raging, matu mamlachos, kingdoms fall. Nasan dekalo, Hashem places his voice, tamok haaretz, the land shakes. Hashem tzvakos, imanu miskavlenu le'ekov salad. What is said about 73, of course, could be said about the entire 20th century. The wars, the tumult, the chaos, fascism, the rise, the fall. When the people of Israel return to the land of Israel, history is in flux. History is moving. It accelerates to the finish line. And that's how Rav Amital tried to draw religious meaning from this Yom Kippur war. The second issue we struggled with, and I use the word struggle because I don't think he had easy answers to this, because there are no easy answers. What are the messianic consequences of this war? So he quoted a Gra, very interesting, who says that our vision of the end of days is focused upon large apocalyptic wars centered upon Yerushalayim, nuclear wars, Armageddon, large-scale wars. The Vilna Gaon said that our tshuva and our tefillos throughout the generations have splintered Gog and Magog. At this point, Gog and Magog may not be one large war, it may just be a series of smaller wars. Because Jewish prayer can affect history, it can change the shape of history. And he never really said this is part of Gog and Magog, because he never crossed that line. He was never confident and brash. This is that, some people were speaking Tanakh. But he never looked at history through the lens of Tanakh, but it was very speculative. But he certainly implied that this may be part of the Gog and Magog process. And that even though, second part, the battle wasn't waged in Yerushalayim, and in Tanakh, the battle of Gog and Magog is situated in Yerushalayim, Zechariah Yudalit. The battle for Yerushalayim doesn't have to be geographically waged in Yerushalayim. The battle for Yerushalayim can be waged in the Suez, it can be waged in the Golan, because in the end it's about Yerushalayim as we know. Whatever's happening in the Golan, whatever's happening in the Suez Canal, it's about who's in Yerushalayim. So the battle in Yerushalayim is not a battle situated in Yerushalayim, it's a battle about Yerushalayim that could be splintered chronologically, could be fragmented, could be situated, dislocated from Yerushalayim. But to me, what made Rav Amital's messianic response to the war so compelling is, I think at this point, I haven't heard this from him before, but I heard it dozens of times afterwards. It's become my redemptive compass. A redemptive process can have lags. A redemptive process can have pauses. A redemptive process can include retreats. A redemptive process can include delays. Redemption is not a straight arc. It's a jagged graph. And he quoted the famous Mishnah Torah source number 8. He's a quote of this on a yearly basis. Why is HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Shir Hashirim compared to a gazelle? Shir Hashirim is a very ambitious sefer. Comparing Hashem to anything is very ambitious. Theologically very audacious. But it's Shir Hashirim. And when we love Hashem and we're married to Hashem, you take extra poetic license. Why is Hashem compared to a gazelle? You wake up one morning in your bungalow, you see a deer outside, call your kids over, by the time the kids come, the deer has disappeared. But it hasn't really disappeared, it just sneaks behind the thicket, and it's still there, it's just it's concealed. So, even the gula of Mitzrayim, which was Chipazim, there was a delay. Chazal tell us that when Moshe was hooted out of the palace in the end of Parsha Shmos, he retreats to Yisrael in Midian for 3 months or 6 months. To the average bystander, it looks like Moshe was a failed Messiah. Ran back to his fatherland with his tail between his legs. But with 2020 hindsight of history, we realize this was just a 6 month lag in the sweep of history. What's 6 months? It's a hiccup. So just like Mitzrayim, which is Chipazon, can have lags and delays and pauses and retreats. Similarly, our Gula, which as Yeshaya tells us, Ki lo b'chipazon teitzei, or lo b'misat teitzei, when you will not exit quickly, can also have those lags and pauses. And he quoted, of course, Rav Kook, source number 9, I couldn't find the digital copy. Nitzotz Tamir, line number 2, Shel Arosh HaMashiach, the sparkling light of Mashiach HaGoel, Shenigla v'nisa v'chazah v'nigla. It appears, it's concealed, it peeks out, and it's camouflaged. Bishvil Kach, Rav Kook writes, in Chazon HaGula, Arenu Rome b'meshach HaMalach, this is before the wars, before the Holocaust. Arenu Rome b'meshach HaMalach, Shot Chiyas Eumo, we see the process of the rehabilitation of our people, our Tavad Yishuv Eretz, and the settling of land, Harpei Chalifos, many gyrations, Aliyot, rises, Rividot, and falls, Kol Yiridah, Harbechini Eskasos. Anytime we fall, it's not that redemption is ended, or we're onto a hold, it's just being concealed. This became so valuable in the 90s, when after Oslo, people were perhaps suggesting we should no longer recite Reshit Tzmichas Gula, saying it can't be redemptive if we're treating from... In 2006, when we withdrew from Aza, it was such a steadying anthem of Rav Amital. It's still redemptive. It may not always be. From 48 till 67, it was stratospheric. It was meteoric. And then it can lag, and then it can pause. And especially during the trying times that we're experiencing now, it's a very trying time. We always had our unity and our solidarity, even though we were hated, even though we could face the entire world alone because we were united. How do we face the entire world when we're splintered? It's part of the pain, it's part of the Chavad Mashiach, part of the challenge of absorbing people from different walks of life, different ethnicities, different places, different backgrounds, different levels of religiosity. And that's what Rav Amital built in the wake of Mohammed Yom Kippur. He quoted the Kol HaTorah, next page, written allegedly by a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. Not clear the controversy what the Talmud of the Vilna Gaon actually wrote this, but Yosef recognized his brothers. They didn't recognize Yosef. This is a metaphor. Yosef is the first bell of Mashiach, Mashiach ben Yosef, the preliminary Mashiach. That first wave of Mashiach is always fated to be unrecognizable, just like Yosef was unrecognizable. Kim Choldar Vadar, source number 10, line 2, Hashem Mashiach ben Yosef, Makir is Echav. The redemption knows its people, but the people don't yet recognize it to be redemptive. Umasa Satanhu, this is actually a satanic act to conceal it. And people can't trace Miklos Mashiach. They got Mizalzel in Ben Bala and St. Harabin. and they discredit it and dismiss it. So to me, more than any messianic takeaway was the ability to distill messianism in a way that, and Zionism in a way that was grounded, that could endure and withstand setbacks and withdrawals. Because redemptive fever is very intoxicating. And once you let that genie out of the bottle, you're facing a range of issues. A range of issues. One of them being unrealistic expectations. And Aramithal created realistic expectations. The third issue we wrestled with was the question, will this country survive? How will it survive? If you're standing in 1973, and every single country requires oil, and the Arabs have almost a monopoly on oil, and they're turning the faucet, they're closing the faucet, unless you support them in their battle against Israel, and they're rattling their sabers, will we survive? Again, that was a question pre-67. For 6 years, no one asked that question, unfortunately. But now, in 1973, people are, I'd say, obsessed with that question. And Rav Aviv built a model of Jewish history to answer this question, which is far more significant than just answering a particular question. Rav Aviv's thesis was that the Jewish people are supernatural. We don't operate based on the normal patterns and the normal influences and the normal factors that govern every nation. We're Hashem's people, and the laws that apply that govern other people do not obtain to our people. As he said himself, and I think this is such a powerful, powerful line, especially in the mid-70s, let's try to face not the question of Mihu Yehudi, who's a Jew, a controversy, but Mahu Yehudi. What does it mean to be a Jew? We know what it is to be a Jew in front of a Shulchan Aruch, black and white, you just follow the trail. What does it mean to be a Jew in history? Because historical consciousness is part of religious consciousness. So how do I view Jewish history? And to me, this was a moment that far transcended how he's going to calm frayed nerves in 1973, 74. Rav Amital articulated 5 bullet points, each of which reflects that we are not a normal, typical nation. We are, as Bilam himself called us, source number 11, Hen am levadad yishkon uvagoyim lo yischashav. Levadad yishkon doesn't mean we dwell alone. We dwell differently. Metaphysically, our reality is different. Levadad yishkon is not just in part, unfortunately, we dwell and we're alienated or the world is alien to us. When Rav Amital spoke about the 67 war, he thought that there was a return to the days of Avram Avinu, when Avram stood on one side of the river, and the entire, because in 1967, no one armed us, no one rallied to our defense. 67, we faced the Arabs alone. In 73, we faced them with the support of the United States. How are we different? Number one, I feel like I'm reading the Maharal, I have to be honest with you. When I read Rav Amital describing Jewish history, I feel like I'm reading Tiferes Yisrael and Netzach Yisrael. The Jewish people evidently are eternal. They've withstood attacks, they've withstood persecution, they've withstood discrimination, they've withstood. And Rav Amital felt it's not just because of our cultural insularity. It's very easy to assign our survival to the fact that we eat differently, and our mores are differently, and our customs are differently, and we dress differently, and our marriages are different. But there's so many other nations throughout history, so many cultures who also have cultural insularity, that they didn't survive the test of time. So for Rav Amital, Netzach Yisrael, the eternity of the Jewish people is inalienable, incontrovertible. There's nothing to do. You can't trace it through historical patterns, political patterns, social patterns. Number one. Number two, also to me seminal. Anti-Semitism is not incidental. Anti-Semitism, though it can be traced externally to political, economic, social, psychological, race theory, as he quoted so often, he didn't actually quote this in his discussions after the war, so I didn't put it on the sources. Lama Nikrishma Sinai, why was it called Har Sinai? As opposed to Horeb. That is when anti-Semitism was born. Again, this is not something that your average anti-Semite would respond with, but there are deeper forces that shape human behavior. We occupy two worlds. This world, where we can trace and a metaphysical world. How exactly do those two worlds interact? What's the interface between our choices and the larger forces? What does that mean about Bechira Chavshus? Hashem is his algorithms. Hitler made a choice. And based on this choice, Hashem provided historical algorithms. But redemption is inevitable. The Rabbi Talmud always tells us a story, I think it would say Mendel. Mendel's job in the shtetl was throwing everyone up during Chodesh Elul. And he was ruthless. He pulled you by the feet, then he threw water on you, and he shook you out of bed. And finally, his Arab Rosh Hashanah, everyone's in shul saying slichos, and Mendel is kashlofer, and Mendel's falling asleep. Everyone takes their slichos books and they start tossing it at Mendel to wake him up. And Mendel looks out of bed, red-eyed and bleary, says, "Can't you let me go schlafen? I'm so exhausted. Can't I just go to sleep?" So they all wave their fingers and say, "Mendel, Mendel, he kept us up all Chodesh Elul. All Chodesh Elul, you didn't let us sleep. Now you think we're going to let you sleep now that it's Rosh Hashanah?" Rabbi Tal said, "We're the Mendel of the world shtetl. For 2,000 years, we kept the world morally and theologically awake. We challenged them to higher ground. We forced them to believe in a one from which comes many, the monotheism. We forced them to believe that that one is a moral spirit, and a moral spirit demands moral accountability. Many gods, no accountability. No accountability, a moral freefall. One God, one set of moral codes, accountable lifestyles. We challenged the world, and we drove as the engine that drives the world to progress in science and democracy. And now it's Rosh Hashanah. Elul's over. It's Rosh Hashanah. It's the end of history. The start of the new era. The fourth room of history. The new era. And all we want to do is go to our home and go to sleep." And the world say, "He kept us awake for 2,000 years. You think we're going to let you go to sleep now?" So they're throwing things at us. Anti-Semitism is not incidental. Anti-Semitism is a very, very powerful statement. It's baked into the fabric of history. It won't end until history ends. That doesn't mean that efforts to curb it or to limit it are not welcome and important. Of course, we live in a much, much better world than any of our ancestors. They're either right arm, even with the rise of anti-Semitism. But don't delude yourself as if we'll just end with enough education and enough common discussion. It's baked in. And all the efforts that people make to curb it are significant. As our Rami Tal said, the source of anti-Semitism, source number 12, Anochi Gadati, Yoshati, I speak, I say, Vishmati, Ve'im Bachem Zar, Ve'atem Eidayin Om Hashem. You're my witnesses. What are we witnesses to? Who are we testifying to? The Medrash says, Dabar Acher, Kishatem Eidayin, Aniel. When you stand for me in this world, my presence is felt. She'enatem Eidayin, Kibayachal Aniel. If you don't stand for me, HaKadosh Baruch Hu suffuses the entire cosmos. HaShemayim U'Shmei HaShemayim Vo'yichal Kalupa. Nothing can contain him. But on this planet, with the blue ozone and the large seas, his presence is completely a product of human decision, completely a product of human behavior, because he endowed us with that capacity. And we can either evict him from this world, or we can either draw him into this world. And we are charged with drawing him into this world, and when we do, he's present. Atem Eidai, you stand testimony, you stand witness to me. Rav Amital taught me to see life as a trajectory, not trajectory, but as a spectrum of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem. I remember growing up in Brooklyn with a lot of dissidents. I heard of Akiva was a martyr, his Makadosh Shem Shemayim, I heard about other martyrs. And then my Rebbe took us to remember Shea Stadium, Mets games. Be careful, don't act unruly, eat your popcorn nicely, because we're going to be Makadosh Shem Shemayim. And another be Makadosh Shem Shemayim. So I walked off to the baseball game, me and Rebbe Akiva were Makadosh Shem Shemayim. It just didn't settle right. He gave his life, I'm eating popcorn properly. But then Rav Amital created this spectrum. Our life represents Hashem. And not just in the Torah we learn and the mitzvos we display, but in the arc of Jewish history. When the Jewish people's condition rises, Hashem's presence is augmented. When the Jewish people's condition, the state of the Jews, declines, the state of the Jews, and then HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence recedes. And the Holocaust was the single greatest Chilul Hashem in history. The state of Israel was a necessary response, and I'll talk about that in a moment. And of course, the most extreme version of Kiddush Hashem, which we hope never to be called to, was martyrdom. Those eight boys and others were called to them. And less extreme versions, we hope to live our lives. Kiddush Hashem is not a death wish. Kiddush Hashem is we hope to live our lives for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But if we really live our lives in Makadosh Baruch Hu, then if we're asking, we have to give it up, because otherwise we're not living it for Him. Unless you're living for something beyond yourself, it's not real passion. The only way to decide whether you're living for something more important than yourself is the willingness to die for it. But that doesn't mean you have a death wish. Sometimes the kids ask me in yeshiva, Rebbe, what does passion mean? So I try to shock them and say, three things I'd be happy to die for if I had to. My people, my Hashem, my people, and my family. I don't have a death wish. I want to live as long as Hashem gives me. But those are the things I live for in my life. And those are more important than me. And if I have to, they're more important than me, because otherwise I'm a fraud. If they're more important than me, then they have to be more important than my life. If called upon, which comes to show. The Rav Amital created this arc of Kiddush Hashem and Chilul Hashem, and the rise of the state of Israel, the success of the state of Israel, not just religiously, economically, militarily, culturally, diplomatically, democratically, was a Kiddush Hashem, that our people were capable of building this experiment. So that was the second bullet point about Jewish history. The third bullet point about Jewish history, remember once he went to Chutzlars, I forget whether Switzerland or Teaneck, but he had never been to Chutzlars. Once he went to Switzerland for the summer, once he went to Teaneck, he went at different times. I forget where this story came about. One of the stories, he came back and he said, Karate at Aitam New York Times. Nivalti. Why? Kokach Rabbeit Yahasut, Eretz Yisrael, Medinat Yisrael. Mamash Kotorot, Manach Nosir. זה שנפלו 500 אנשים במקסיקו, זה מומצא איזה חנוי דף מספר 5. You know, something happened in Mexico, 500 people were killed. It's a small item on that. Page 5. But the Jewish people, what happens in the occupied territories and Palestinian state, front pages, headlines, UN resolutions. A proportion, that. I said a proportion earlier, if you know, it doesn't have, it's out of all whack, it's out of all proportion. Why are they so interested? Why do they hold us up to those? And I'm not one of these people, we never was one of those people that digs their heels in and we're not wrong and we shouldn't be critiqued. Of course we have to listen, of course, but just take a few steps back and assess the disproportionate attention paid to the Jewish people. Once again, this is not attention being paid to the Jewish people. Shalom and Mirgos, and history is moving forward. 1967, the world shuddered. For some, that shudder was exciting. For Christian fundamentalists, their end game again. For others, that was a shudder of resentment and opposition. 48, no one shuddered. 67, the world shuddered. 48 was a compassionate gesture to a nation of refugees, finding a homeland for them. 67 was a return to the homeland and to the biblical corridor of the homeland, not just the Yerushalayim. So number three, the disproportion. Number one, the infinite nature of Am Yisrael. Number two, anti-Semitism is incidental and political. Number three, the disproportionate treatment of our people. Number four, Rav Amital always refused to create equilibrium of any sort or symmetry of any sort between the Holocaust and the state of Israel. The closest he ever came was, as I said before, the Holocaust was a Chilul Hashem, the greatest Chilul Hashem since the Holy Beis HaMikdash, and that Chilul Hashem demanded a response to restore Hashem's presence. And he quoted the Pesukim in Yechezkel, Barakah. But you can't help but notice the intensity and the juxtaposition. Proximity of these two events, as Rav Amital said, could you imagine if in a couple thousand years the archaeologists unearthed relics and artifacts from the Holocaust, and they unearthed relics and artifacts from the return of the Jewish people to sovereignty, they would assume, the archaeologists, that these were events that were separated by hundreds of years. How could a nation beaten, beleaguered, gutted of its wealth, dehumanized, scattered across the earth, not just resettle their homeland thousands of miles away, but wage a torrential battle to defend it against hordes of invading armies? So the intensity and the proximity of 1945 to 1948 was another indicator that our history is different and our arc is different. And then finally, of course, the migration. As Parshas Beis Chana says, I don't think I put it here, Nisa Lukim Laval Lakachas Logoi Nikar of Goi. This has never happened. I didn't put the story down as a Kodesh Baruch Hu ever. Taken a nation and traveled with them across the globe, halfway around the earth, to return them to their land. Kibbutz Galus. The return of people from all over the world to our country. These were five issues which Rav Amital indicated Netzach Yisrael. And that Netzach Yisrael can't be assessed or determined based on Cold War dynamics, based on. I remember the thought I had when Israel celebrated its 70th anniversary. How long did the Soviet Union last? 69 years. Could you imagine having a DeLorean? You know what I mean, right? Sure. And going back in time and waging a bet in 1960, which empire would last longer, the Soviet Union or the State of Israel? You get some pretty good odds on that bet. You can walk away a rich man. Because Vegas doesn't factor in Jewish metaphysical history. Vegas just knows weapons and culture and government. Vegas doesn't think about metaphysics. And the anti-Semitism for Avamital, as odd as it sounds, is reaffirming. Remember, secular Zionism assumed that anti-Semitism was solely a product of this odd arrangement where you had a strange nation being hosted by other nations, and once this nation had its own homeland, anti-Semitism would wither. And at least for Avamital, he quoted Rav Kook, and Rav Kook says this earlier, for Avamital, the 73 war convinced him that anti-Semitism is still alive. In ways that the Six-Day War and 48 did not. So it's number 16. Ulam kayemes gan tzionut acheret, as opposed to the Zionism of secularists. Di tzionut shel geulah. He mishameshes, this is a speech he gave in Yeshiva, 1974, 1975. Mishameshes line number 4, machshir bidei hashgacha elyonah, a tool for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lekadem es Yisrael lekras geulaso. So to summarize, these are the three issues that Avamital struggled with, ideologically. Religious meaning, Yom Kippur, internationalization, messianic residence, maybe it's Gog or Magog, more importantly, there could be retreats and pauses. And what does this tell us about Jewish identity? Not Mir Yehudi, but Mao Yehudi. These five issues, for him, emerge more clearly in Answer 73 than they had before, or at least here. No, you don't. I want to conclude by something I alluded to before, not how Avamital responded ideologically to the war, but how he responded at a human level. And I want to talk about two issues, and you saw it in the movie. What you saw happening, what we saw happening in 1973, hadn't happened in thousands of years, where Rabbanim actually visited their Talmidim in the middle of the war, the front ranks of the war. Jewish soldiers always fought in our wars, but they never fought as religious battalions. There wasn't Hesder, there weren't frameworks. Maybe there's one. But Hesder, as an institution, came of age in the years between 1967 and 1973. Sadly, it bore the very, very heavy burden to the casualties because the Hesder boys were placed in tank units and those were facing the front line. The fact that we lost 8 boys in Yeshiva wasn't circumstantial because we were fighting in tank units. And I was standing. Famous story, Rabbi was standing by the door of the yeshiva, Yom Kippur, as they're filing out to go to their divisions and to go to their units. And he was handing each boy, you can fill in that, but you'll never guess, as you heard it from me, it's a quiet story. He was handing each boy a roll of toilet paper.
It was
in the movie.
Not in the movie, I'm sorry.
No,
and the emunah they had for the Talmidim, and as you saw in the movie, at the end of the movie, like they felt like being inspired by the Talmidim. I'll tell you two stories that Avamital told. One of them told by a machat, Mefakei Chativa, thousands of soldiers. He said that one night they were facing a very difficult battle, so they gathered all the soldiers and said, let's talk about it, I want everyone to be on the same page, and let's make a joint decision, because they knew there'd be a lot of casualties. And then as the meeting adjourned, one of the Talmidim slammed his head and said, but tomorrow is Sukkot, we don't have Dalet Minim. Sukkot is when we broke through the Syrian lines, that's what the Tishrei. So order Dalet Minim. So the Machat gets on the line, we need X amount of tanks and Y amount of missiles and Z amount of bullets, and we need Dalet Minim. And here's this gasp on the other line, what is Dalet Minim and how are you going to get that? But the Machat says, you follow. The next day at dawn, the tanks came, the bullets came, the ammunition came, and the Dalet Minim came. And what a joy it was for them with Tetzvah Tishrei as they're breaking through the ranks to be once again surrounded by the Nanei Kavod as we celebrate on Sukkot. Another story Avamital told him, I remember doing the Lebanon War, I was here in the 80s, the Lebanon War. Remember, Lichtenstein would helicopter into Lebanon on a daily basis, but helicopter would land in the army base right near Yeshiva. And he would deliver, Sicho and Shmuzin and meet the boys, and we still, as part of our legacy, we're always going to army bases to visit the Talmidim. I just hope I don't get the ones up north. Happy to go south. What is the 4-hour trip up to the north? I think I'm out. I'll leave it to the younger guys. That's part of the legacy of Yeshiva. And not just the religious soldiers, but the non-religious soldiers who had a religious epiphany, facing the horrors of war, seeing the courage of our soldiers, seeing the intervention of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we're asking Rabbi Amitabh because they're unsure. We underestimate how unsure and uncertain non-religious people are about religion when they confirm religion. So I say, we're natural. We engage with religion naturally. We're second skin. But for people who weren't religious, they were asking, where tefillah's heard, where tefillah's heard, like that soldier asked Rabbi Medan, please branch a Berchas Agoyal, Berchas Agoyal. And Rabbi Amitabh is famous. This is a pasuk that was a staple of his. Karim Hashem l'chol karav l'chol ha'sheikhu v'emes. And who knows who has more emes. Well, I have more MS because I was raised for him, but you have more MS because he's just a good, courageous, patriotic person fighting on behalf of his people. Hashem Shema B'Kole, Hashem, listen not to my voice, but listen to what's within my voice. Shema B'Kole, not Shema Kole. Listen to the depths of my voice, to the depths of my truth. I remember very often during the Eilat, Rabbi Amitabh would tell us, Karav Hashem, L'chol Karav, L'chol Hashem, K'ruv MS. And who here can actually approach a Kodesh Baruch Hu with MS? We live in a fallen world. We're all frauds. We're all artifice. We all conceal ourselves from ourselves. And there was a pregnant silence, and I think that 99% of the sikhot did the following term. But boys, it's Ne'ilah, and you fasted 24 hours, and try your hardest as much as you can to bring some MS, whatever little MS you can deliver. Try to approach your Baruch with MS. That's futile. None of you will ever be MS. But there's another pasuk. Karav Hashem L'Yishburi Lev. Just bring your broken heart to Hashem. Even if it's not MS. And you start crying and telling us how broken hearted we are after the Holocaust and how broken hearted we are after coming in. The room was full of tears. And there's a beautiful, beautiful recording of Amitabh. I alluded to it earlier. About an 8-minute recording. 2003, and get into the families. And with this I'll end. Not just how I responded to the soldiers, but how I responded to the families. You saw Rav Lichtenstein describing Rav Amitabh and how he processed an entire year as if he was going to be 25. And how Rav Amitabh told him, you take the keys, I can't fuck this. As Rav Aaron said, that was a moment of strength. And a moment of cowardice. On the other hand, Rabbi Amitabh once told us, he said, I was broken. I didn't have the strength to continue. But I knew that people needed me to be strong. And I knew that people needed me to radiate confidence. And for anyone else, it would sound fraudulent, as if you're putting one back, but Rabbi Amitabh is so vulnerable and so honest that that mixture of acknowledging your weakness, but still presenting a strong. I can't tell you how many times in my life I think about that story. I don't have the strength, but I have to have the strength because people need me to have the strength. So I'll find the strength. I was speaking to the mother of one of the 8 boys, the daughter of Asher Yehuda, and I went to the Azkara the other week. And this is 50 years later. There must have been 50 people in the room. People I never met in, teenagers. They were bawling and talking about how deeply this person they never met and the picture on the wall had influenced their lives. Breathtaking, sociologically, not just religiously. A person who lived to the age of 24, 50 years later, a whole room of people were affected by his short life and his death. And I asked this daughter, who's now a mother, grandmother, I said, how are you so successful in perpetuating this person's memory throughout the years? It's 50 years later. And she said, because Rav Amitabh and Rav Aaron always showed up. Every year, and believe me, it's not easy to show up. You're not showing up when you're out of Kislev. It's Yud Aleph Tishrei. The last I checked, there's a lot to do in Yud Aleph Tishrei. It's called Sukkos and Dalamina and cooking, and we all know that those 4 days are hairy. They always showed up, they always supported the family. And I'll end with the following Rav Amitabh story because it's so classic Rav Amitabh. I think a year after the 8 boys were killed, Rav Amitabh was invited to speak in Rehovot in the shul. For an askara for Benny Gal. Benny Gal was one of the boys who saw. He's actually a younger boy. Incredible story there was. I'm really sure I'm going to finish at 9:50, right? So, incredible story there was. Anyway, Rav Amitabh gets to Rehovot, and there are meant to be 2 speakers for Benny Gal. And then all of a sudden, Rav Amitabh being one of them, there's another boy who had fallen, not the Talmud of his, who was also on the program. This was an askara for 2 fallen soldiers. He never wrote the story. I heard the story from a person he told me this. It's a very secret story, a personal story. And Rav Amitabh was at first very opposed. It's an aloha ema stidim shayim kiyachat. You don't ever eulogize two people side by side because of the obvious danger of lack of equivalency. But he'd been invited. These were soldiers. Everyone gathered. What could he do? So Rav Amital was meant to end the program. He was the fourth speaker. Speaker number one got up and spoke about Benny Gal. He's telling a beautiful, beautiful eulogy about his life, his martyrdom. Next speaker got up and spoke about Benny Gal. Third speaker got up to speak about this other Talmud, this other soldier. And the person gave a generic Dvar Torah. He gave a Dvar Torah, and he hooked it up to the person's life, but he didn't really speak about this fallen soldier. Rav Amital read the room and realized if he gets up and speaks about his Talmud, that will be three hasnayim for Benny Gal, while no one has said a word about this other person. So in the 5 or 10 minutes that speaker number three was giving his Dvar Torah, Rav Amital asked a couple people from the other soldier's family, tell me a few stories about this person in his life. And on the spot, he composed a hesped for this person who wasn't a student. And he never eulogized his own student. And the nice part of the story is, Benny's parents are very, very noble people. They understood. They understood where Rav Amital did what he did. This is how I think he responded to the struggle, to the camouflage truths. But once he lifted the veil, he walked away with basic tenets of Jewish history, basic tenets of responsible messianism, basic tenets of Kiddush Hashem, and more importantly, he created a new tradition, which sadly we still have to adopt, the tradition of Rabbanim, living the Shchol, living the loss of the Talmud. For thousands of years, we didn't have to suffer that. But as he once told us the story, I think he told us the story, after about 20 years ago, there was a fire up in the Carmel, and they sent a busload of 20 prison guards to try to help put out the fire, and unfortunately, the bus went up in flames. And an old man in Yerushalayim, he told me the story, so I said, how could we lose 50 Jewish in the fire brigade? And he said, but at least it's our fire brigade. At least it's our fire brigade. For centuries, we had the luxury of doling out these responsibilities to Irish firemen, to Italian policemen, and it's our fire brigade, it's our army, it's our people, it's in our state, and God help us preserve and appreciate the gift he's given us. And I thank you for your patience and for your tolerance, which is a very important thing.
Thank you.